Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening, everyone. You're all on mute, so I can't hear you, but I can see you. Thank you, Craig, for helping with the service. Tonight, I'll be giving a way-seeking mind talk. For those of you who don't know what that is, that's someone talks about how they came to practice, so how they came to Zen practice. And we will do that for maybe half an hour and then have time for questions at the end. So I'm going to start with a little bit about my childhood. I grew up in the Bay Area, born in the Bay Area in a little town called El Sobrante, which means leftovers. They actually created there was the rich area, which was Pinole and Carriage Hills. And then they had the kind of ghettos of San Pablo where a lot of the gangs were. And then there was this little strip of land in between and they just called it leftovers. So that's where I grew up. And my mom was multi-generation American, having Norwegian ancestry as well as English and French. And my dad was an immigrant from Thailand. So very different cultures and expectations. And I always kind of felt that I was in two worlds. I felt that in some ways I was very privileged compared to a lot of kids in the world. I never went hungry. I had a lot of opportunities to go to Disneyland and on vacations with my aunt and her family. But I also had a lot of challenges. I grew up in actually a pretty chaotic environment. So there was mental illness in my family. And I don't want to go too much into the weeds, but I want to give you a few glimpses so you can get a sense into the chaos in which I was born. My dad had a lot of kind of addictive personality, addicted to credit cards, and was always kind of looking for the next thing. So he'd have hobbies that would take over the house, like electric guitars, or he'd get into ham radio and build a giant tower in the backyard. And he even got into exotic animals. And so at one point we had 18 snakes living in the house. So I'd come home from high school and go to use my computer. And the first thing I need to do is a snake has gotten out of its cage and I need to detangle a python from electrical cords before I can use the computer for my homework. So I got pretty used to crazy things happening out of nowhere. I remember one day I was in my early teens, maybe 15 years old, and I had used the restroom and I accidentally dropped a ring or a keychain, something in the toilet. And it jammed and I said, "Dad, help me, I accidentally dropped something and I can't get it out of the toilet." And he said, "Oh, well, we need to replace the toilet anyway." He went and got a hatchet. He started hacking the floor of the bathroom, ripped out the toilet. There's water everywhere. There's a giant hole in the bathroom. And then he's like, "Oh, looks like there's water damage on this wood too." He started pulling apart the entire bathroom. And then he kind of just lost interest and said, "I think I'll deal with this later." And after that, this bathroom that I had used every day of my life just never worked again. And we all had to use the bathroom in my parents' house. So that was the kind of just random instability that became a normal part of my life to absorb. When I was 2 years old, my mom became deathly sick with a Demerol poisoning. She had an allergic reaction at a dentist office. And so she was unable to care for me and my little brother. And well, he's actually older than me, but we were both small at that age. So we stayed with my aunt, and there everything in the house was impeccable. Everything was in order, 3 meals a day. Yet when I was at home, it was kind of like, if you're hungry, find something in the freezer and put it in the microwave and feed yourself. So I learned to go back and forth between different worlds, some where the household was very religious, somewhere it wasn't religious at all, somewhere it was neat and orderly and you had rules and bath time and bedtime, and other times where there was just no structure at all. But like I said, I did have some privilege as well. My grandparents were pretty well off and their house was actually very zen. Everything was neat and in order. And we used to joke that if you went into any room, all of the carpet hairs would face the same direction. That's how orderly it was. So I always thought that they would like Zen in some way. But with my parents, there wasn't really a lot of room for discussing feelings or ideas. I don't even think that they had enough space to really process their own feelings, let alone process the feelings of a child. So anything like questioning what the church taught about God or any difficulties I had, we just didn't talk about it. We just were taught, you know, just say nice things, don't talk about problems. And that was very difficult. It was very isolating. But throughout all this chaos, there was one thing that I loved as a child. I really loved to read. I was a total bookworm. So I would look forward to every couple weeks, we'd get this 2-sheet Scholastic newspaper book with the little previews of these are the kids' books coming out, and I got to order whichever ones I wanted. And I looked forward to that so much, to ordering my books and when my books would come. And I read everything. I mean, I read Tom Sawyer, I read mysteries and scary books, I read Ramona Quimby and Fudge and like Judy Blume. And I'd get so in love with my books, like so hooked, I'd start reading them at recess. And then when recess was over and we were back in the classroom, I would be like sneaking peeks at my book and reading it under my desk. And sometimes I got caught and got in trouble, but that was just how absorbed I was in this story. And I thought that I just liked reading, but looking back, I realized that it was actually my way of making human connection. Because my family didn't talk about problems, or my family didn't talk about how to, you know, collaborate and work through issues. We just kind of pretended that problems didn't exist. And then periodically people would blow up and fight about money and some furniture would get destroyed, you know, but we didn't really learn how to negotiate and problem solve. So even though I read some of those books when I was a very young child, I still remember them vividly. I remember Ramona Quimby was so warm and comfortable in her pajamas that she wanted to keep them on when she went to school. So she snuck them under her school clothes and was wearing her pajamas, and she was all warm and cozy for about 10 minutes. And then by the time she got to school, she was sweating and drenched and super hot and uncomfortable. And I remember thinking, how is she going to get out of this? You know, what's she going to do? And I became fascinated with characters in books and how they solved life's dilemmas, how they worked through really challenging problems, who they had crushes on, and then they weren't reciprocated. Or I still remember, Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. That was a book about a young girl coming of age, and she has Jewish ancestry and Jewish relatives as well as Christian relatives, and she's struggling with her identity of, well, who am I then? You know, and I could relate to that because I was, well, my dad actually practiced Buddhism in his younger years, but I don't think he was too serious about it. He kind of wanted to just get away from home, so he went to the monastery to get away from his parents. But I felt like that in a lot of ways, you know, being multiracial, having very wealthy family members. And also at times we had no money because of my parents' mental illness, to where we couldn't even turn on the heat in the winter. So I remember like going into the bathroom and sitting up on the sink and pouring hot water over my feet because the hot water wasn't turned off. And that's how I stayed warm, was like fill the sink with hot water, put the feet in there. And then when it gets cold, put more hot water in. So, but at the same time, I had experiences that a lot of kids wouldn't get to have. Like my dad became fascinated with ski races. So we would be taken up to the ski slopes and put into racing tournaments on skis before, like soon after I could walk. So it was a very chaotic experience of kind of feeling very privileged in one sense and then feeling very deprived in the kind of emotional and family normal connection. Like, why can't my parents just go get groceries and, you know, pour cranberry juice like other kids' parents, you know? And I think every kid kind of thinks that their parents are crazy or their family's a little crazy. And actually, one thing I did realize after many years, because I suffered a lot thinking, why is my family crazy? My parents are definitely mentally ill, all of this. Then I got into the world and I realized, okay, we're all mentally ill. Okay. and we're all mentally well as well. But all you have to do is, like, you know, watch the debates for the primaries and it looks like something off of Jerry Springer. It's like, okay, you know, the dysfunctionality is not just my family. It's kind of like, as a society, we're struggling with some things. And that's how it is. And that's part of the journey. But going back to my love of reading, it was something that was deeply fulfilling for me. And I even got my little sister hooked on books too. I would give her my favorite books to read. And then when she got through one, she'd have a little present. I'd leave it waiting on the piano and she would open it, be a little toy or candy or something. And she totally got hooked on reading to the point where I would just wrap the next book for her to read. So when she finished one, she would unwrap the next one. And that way we got to share a lot of books, of our favorite books together. I did try writing sometimes, but it was really hard. There were a couple times where my mom found my journal and I had written something, you know, I was angry or something, and I got lectured about it, about how I need to say nice things and, you know, don't say bad things about your cousin and whatever if we got in a fight. And I always was scared of saying the wrong thing. And I was afraid because of my pen, and my pen told the truth. And I was scared of the truth. I was scared that I'd get in trouble, that someone would get mad at me. So I really didn't write very much, but I loved reading. And we'll skip forward a little ways. I was 16 years old, or sometime in my adolescence. I went to El Cerrito High School. And after school, sometimes I would walk to Solano Avenue in Albany. I don't know if you've ever been there. And they had a used bookstore, Half Price Books. And I would buy used books and read them. And one day I bought this book. It's called Wild Mind. Something about that just occurred to me, maybe because I was trying to be so good and proper all the time. But this was Wild Mind by Natalie Goldberg. Didn't know who she was, but I think I glanced through it. And I actually still remember it was on the bottom floor. You had to go downstairs and it was on the back shelf. I still remember exactly where I picked it up. And I didn't get to read it right away. There were a number of, I guess you could say, tumultuous events that happened in my adolescence. And I actually didn't read this book until I was 25 and I was going through a divorce. I had only been married for 2 years. And well, we weren't divorced yet, but we were basically planning on it. Neither of us were really happy. It was a very short marriage. But I remember it was around holidays, because that was like the only time I had free from like technical demands of Silicon Valley to actually read. So I would read a lot during like Christmas break, and I wouldn't even start a Harry Potter book anytime except holidays, because I knew I'd stay up reading it like all weekend. That's how much I would get into the books. So I stopped by my parents' house and I was going through old books, and I had this huge pile of just get rid of these. And I saw this one and I said, I still want to read this one. I'm not going to get rid of it. I kept it. And I read it on a plane flight from San Francisco to Miami, Florida, on a trip to see my husband's family. And as I was reading it on the plane, it was like a friend that had always known me and knew everything about me was sitting right next to me, encouraging me and telling me to write. And they understood my mind completely. They understood my history. It was that vivid. Like, I felt a presence there. And I pulled out a notebook and I started writing. All of my writer's block and stuff just dropped away. And I picked up a pen. I started filling a notebook. And I basically never stopped. I kept writing ever since then. I was 25 years old. And something about this book broke me open. and broke open the way I saw things. I don't remember everything from the book, and Natalie's written like 15 books, so I can't all remember what was in each one, but I remember her writing about frying an egg and thinking about it from the perspective of the egg. Like, you know, things like that. She just had a way of turning it upside down, as well as talking about monkey mind and, you know, I'll come back to this, but I want to tell you why that clicked, why something was there where I felt she understood me. Because the truth was, she never met me before. She didn't know anything about me. A couple years later, I showed up at my first retreat, which was a writing and meditation workshop. Because I was like, this book made such a difference for me. I was like, huh, well, let me find out who this Natalie person is. I didn't know she was famous. This isn't even her most well-known book. She was known for writing Down the Bones. But I was like, I just want to go to a retreat. So I went to my first retreat in 2010. And by then I had read a lot of Natalie's books. And I still remember the first thing we did, sitting meditation, walking meditation, writing. And I remember the moment when I first met her. I was in this beautiful adobe building in Taos, New Mexico, Mabel Dodge Lujan House. It's a historic building. It's really quite remarkable. And I was writing in the lounge, scribbling away in my notebook, because I kept writing. I would write for hours and hours. Sometimes I'd be compelled at night, like I couldn't go to bed if I didn't write. And I was sitting there writing, and I looked up, and the door had this beautiful curved archway with one of those old-fashioned wooden doors in this historic suite. And I looked up, and she was standing right there in the doorway, and she just smiled at me. She didn't say anything. She just smiled, like watching me write, and she just waved. And something happened for me in that moment where it wasn't like meeting a celebrity or a fan type thing. It was much more magical than that, because I had read about her in books. She wrote books about her life. She wrote about Katagiri Roshi. She wrote about, for me, she was like a character in a story. I still remember little Natalie, little Nat, hiding in the girls' restroom to eat her grandmother's chopped liver sandwich because she didn't want her friends to make fun of her, because she loved her grandmother's chopped liver sandwich, and that was a Jewish thing, and the American kids were grossed out by that. Like, I could remember details about her life, never having lived her life, because I read her books, and suddenly she was there, a real human being. It was almost like, imagine Tom Sawyer or Huckleberry Finn just popping up in front of you. It was like, you're a real person. And I realized that writers were real people, that they had real minds, and that they weren't all really old or dead people from England. You know, it made them a lot more accessible in a way. And I realized when I started practicing with Nat, and that was my introduction basically into Zen, that the reason I felt like she knew me really well, even though she'd never met me, was because she knew herself really well. She had taken the time to study her own mind. And I thought, how do you know me? How do you understand me? It's because she understood herself. And when you understand your own mind really deeply, you understand human mind. You understand the first layer is what we call like discursive mind or discursive thinking. It's usually like your to-do list, like, oh man, I gotta take out the laundry, and there's these basil plants at Canando. I need to go pick up one, and I hope someone's watering them because they might die if no one's watering them. It's just like your to-do list. Like, oh, there's a sale on tuna fish across, I better buy it before, you know, it's just all this stuff. You can also get into like fearful mind or afraid of doing things. So monkey mind is, it's actually is a Buddhist term. It's like when your mind is behaving like a monkey, it's literally jumping from this branch to that branch. And, you know, I've noticed interesting things. My mind will entertain itself. Sometimes during Zazen, I hear music playing, a lot of Zumba songs, because I used to be a regular Zumba instructor. So I'll get like these Latin pop songs coming up during meditation. I'm like, oh, that station again, right? Your mind is, the human mind is just amazing. Then we also have, so there's fearful mind when we act out of our own like insecurities and our feelings of smallness. There's expansive mind, there's no mind, right? there's the state you're in when you're not thinking any words, you're just present with what's here right now. And there's beginner's mind. The beginner's mind is like a state of wonder and curiosity where you don't know anything for sure. And so you're always just like, I wonder about this. Let's try this. And it's a very open and receptive state of mind. So, and then there's, of course, all kinds of other types of mind. There's, you know, all these patterns that are in humanity. I mean, there's the victim perpetrator pattern. You can recognize that when you're in that, because like the perpetrator is like, I'm going to get that person back and I'm going to zing them. I'm going to put them in their place. And sometimes when someone harms us, we get those thoughts. It's like, oh, okay, that's the victim perpetrator paradigm. I don't want to entertain that today. And when we're feeling like a victim, then it's like, the whole world is against me. No one cares. Everything I do is wrong. I'm so helpless. And then that's when we feel like the other side. So we can start to recognize thought patterns, and that thoughts and states of mind of human consciousness have like a whole life of their own. They're actually contagious. You know, we can be in an environment that's positive and uplifting, and it's easier for us to then be positive and uplifting. And then we can go to a super competitive and, you know, cutthroat environment, and we come out feeling like this, you know? So if there's anything that Natalie taught me, the most important thing is she taught me to trust my own mind, to accept my own mind. Trust is a completely different thing. You trust yourself, but the main thing is we accept whatever comes up. Like, okay, I'm really angry right now, and it's totally irrational, and it's draining me of my energy, but just looking at that anger. Okay, what's underneath that? Okay, the anger's telling me something needs to change. Okay, the anger's telling me that this something, one of my boundaries was crossed and I'm upset about it and I need to do something so that it doesn't keep happening. Like, we just accept whatever comes up and we try to look at why these themes come up and observe, you know, take a step back. So writing practice was a real gift because it taught me like to just, I guess, let go of control or trying to control things, just write and let whatever is there come out. And in a way it's similar to meditation, which we also practice, which is letting thoughts come and letting thoughts go. So my retreats in Taos and Santa Fe were amazing. I studied there for 8 years and would go multiple seasons. Taos was beautiful. I still remember outside of Mabel Dodge, there was a courtyard, cobblestone courtyard, and I would sweep during work period. My job was to like sweep the cobblestone courtyard and get all the pebbles off. And I'd sweep them all off during like breakfast. And by lunch, they were all back, you know, all the pebbles. And I realized it was okay because that was the practice. The practice wasn't about getting to somewhere, getting to where all the cobblestones are clean. It was about being here now and practicing taking care of things. And I actually love that about Canando is that everything is so well taken care of. Wherever I go, actually, that's Zen. Where Zen is, Canando here in Mountain View, or Upaya, which had these adobe buildings, what's characteristic of Zen is everything is so cared for. And I cannot even tell you how healing that is after coming from a chaotic childhood where things were very much not taken care of. I mean, to come to Canando and to see a rock, and that rock is completely clean, and that rock is employed. It has a job, which is to sit on these papers and make sure they don't blow away. And it's perfectly centered, and it was put there with great attention to detail. And that's a beautiful, beautiful thing. And there's a certain just magic of paying attention, a simple magic of paying attention. I still remember there was one session we had at Canando, and it was during our Orioki lunchtime, and someone's spoon was in a bowl of quinoa and it just fell, and this quinoa splashed onto the Zendo floor. And immediately the Shoshu was there with this black cloth and it just swooshed it up and it vanished, right? And that was a kind of magic. It's like everything is so paid attention to and cared for that the quinoa barely hit the floor and started scattering. And then there was this swoosh and it was gone. You know, you don't get that kind of attention everywhere else. That was a tangent. I wasn't planning on saying that, but it was a beautiful thing. So when I started these retreats, they were wonderful. I'd come back all peaceful and centered and clear about what I need to do. And it would last about 2 weeks. And then I'd get caught up in the rat race again. And I told people, like, I'd be driving down the street to work and realize that I left my phone at home and my shirt is on inside out. Like, that's how much it was just go, go, go. And I realized, I need a practice at home. I need somewhere close by. The great thing about practicing in Taos with Natalie is that no one did it by accident. I mean, you had to take like two airplanes to get there, then take a shuttle through the desert of all of this sage and just emptiness and go up a giant mountain to this like ancient, a mansion, right? That was owned. And so people didn't end up in this desert, you know, and then there's the altitude. I forget how many thousands of feet up. So you have to take like chlorophyll so you don't pass out, right? So no one goes to these remote locations by accident. Like if you're going there, you're going there to practice. And I think that's why she went there. It was kind of to defer all of the casual, curious onlookers and to attract the serious practitioners. And sometimes, often, Zen monasteries are in remote locations like this, like Tassajara. You have to go up this windy road, totally off the grid, take a little shuttle or you know, pay attention to the signs and get a four-wheel drive to get there. Where Katagiri practice was in Minnesota, it was freezing cold. I have not been there, but I've heard stories of how cold it was. We hear about Aheiji. So for a long time, Zen has been in these less convenient locations where people really had to push themselves to go. And it's wonderful, except if you can't stay there and then you're trying to integrate back with everyday life. And that's why I really appreciate Canando, which was started by Suzuki Roshi and then Les K, because it was really made for working everyday people that work in high tech and work in Silicon Valley and have families and can't just go off to the monastery. And that's been a big question. How do we integrate practice into everyday life? And I think I first visited around 2011, and at first it was a little spotty, and then after a couple of years I started coming very regularly. So at first I was like, okay, as soon as my schedule clears up and as soon as work becomes more manageable, I'm going to come like every week. And then of course I realized that in Silicon Valley, work never calms down and it's never sane and there's never space. So you just have to set a limit and go. So I still remember my first time visiting Canando, and I remember the Dharma talk that night, and Les said, life is important. And because life is important, your life is important. And because life is important, your life is not important. This is a paradox. So I sat with that and realized that eventually you come to see that your life is very, very important, but it's just not important in the way you originally thought it was. It's not important in this own kind of secluded sense, that actually our life, my life, your life, is part of something much, much greater, with a much greater significance than it appears to be, and connected to much more than it appears to be. So I really appreciated Canando because it was kind of a, like, it was a place of sanity in a place of kind of complete chaos. You know, it was I never thought about it this way, but in a way, like Canando was my reading, my way of reading books. It was like, now I'm connecting with real people and solving problems and, you know, figuring out how to do this whole life thing and not cause harm. While still everything around us is chaotic, you know, there's still wars. And I mean, all you have to do is turn on the news and see that, okay, yeah, the world is crazy. Okay. That's part of it. That's okay. And why I say that we all have mental illness in a sense to some degree is because none of us can completely see everything very clearly all of the time. We all have Maya. We all have this delusion that can keep us from seeing things completely clearly. And at the same time, we also are all enlightened beings that can see things perfectly well. So, like, everything, all of these different consciousnesses, I can't pronounce that word, multiple consciousness, you know, enlightened, peaceful, deluded, all of them exist in the realm of human consciousness. And it's just a matter of which ones we choose to express and we choose to engage. And the practice gives us that ability so that we don't just react and do our automatic programming. I was thinking the other day that we think so much that our thoughts are our own. Like, this is my identity, these are my thoughts. And really, how much of our thoughts were not planted there by someone else or multiple someone else's? I mean, even the language that we use has been passed down for generations, absorbed by our environment. Even every single English word and any language even, like, has a birth date and sometime a death date, and it can go through evolutions of meaning. So we are absorbing through our culture, through our environment, all of the time, these different thoughts and different ideas. And the practice allows us to see that, to see our pre-programming, to see our default autopilot that we get, that's the status quo, and then to consciously choose whether we want to engage that thought or we want to choose something different, a more thoughtful response to the situation. So for me, the practice has really been a path to mental health, a path to seeing things clearly, a path to accepting ourselves and loving ourselves even when we don't do things perfectly. And I think the more that we're able to accept our own mind and accept our moments of anger, accept our moments of sadness, accept our shadow side, the more we can accept it, that we're not, you know, that we have behaviors that we don't like or ideas that we don't like, the more we're able to be compassionate towards other people and see that when they act out, okay, they're suffering. And so I think it's just been really wonderful. So I kind of came into Zen from a side door. I came thinking I was going to a writing workshop. I still remember Natalie was wearing her rakasu, and I knew nothing about Zen or Buddhism. I didn't know what a rakasu was, and I thought it was a pencil holder. So I thought, oh, Natalie's a writer. That must be where she keeps her pens. She cracked up laughing when I told her that. But it's been really wonderful, and I feel so fortunate to have found this practice, so fortunate to have had such wonderful teachers, first Natalie and now Les, and the Sanghas as well, all of you. So that's pretty much how I came to Zen, and I'm really glad. I feel like all of you are part of my family, and now I'm open for questions.
Yeah, Bonnie, thank you so much for your talk. I was particularly struck by what you said about because life is important, you're important, and because life is important, you're not important. One of my long enduring interests in life is all about learning about astronomy and cosmology and everything, how big the universe is, how old it is, how many stars there are, all that kind of stuff. And that's a different way, of course, of approaching the whole question of, you know, I mean, it's not the same thing as saying big mind, but it's kind of a different way of looking at the same question. One of the things that I find so interesting is that I periodically run into people who find that sort of thing very disturbing and sort of terrifying. It's like, it makes me feel so small. It makes life seem so short. It makes me seem insignificant and all of that. And I find it very hard to understand that reaction, because it just means that we're part of something that's so grand and so old and so big, and that feeling of being a part of that, how can you possibly react with that kind of fear and everything? It's really sort of symptomatic of a whole different way of looking at life that you know, I mean, it makes you feel compassion for people who react that way. But when somebody says that, I just don't really know what to say to them. You know, it's such a grand and glorious thing that we're a part of, and it feels so good.
Thank you, Dave. I think the suffering in that case and the fear really comes from the feeling of separateness, the illusion of separateness. And that's a tough one. It's like, oh, just know that you're connected to the whole universe and everything. I mean, it's something that I think you have to kind of experience bit by bit. It's hard to just, you can't just say, oh, believe that you're connected to it. But another thing I've realized is that a lot of times the questions are more important than the answers. And the questioning mind is actually more valuable than the answers. So when we talk about cosmology and things like, or anything, if we have an answer, that's the right answer for that day and it'll get us through the day. If we have a questioning mind, we can keep discovering new answers all the time. We can keep discovering the way. So one way I might engage someone like that is just to open them up to the mystery of, this is something that helps me a lot when people die. It's knowing that, well, whatever great mystery had the brilliance to create this human being and give birth to this human being is going to have that same brilliant plan for how to manage the end of their life or where they go from here, you know, without having to subscribe to any dogma. It's like, well, if we're scared of looking at the bigger universe and that I might die someday, let me think about, well, how did I get created in the first place? Like I didn't create myself. I didn't manufacture kidneys in my basement, or I can't take credit for this. None of us can. And so we have to know that our life is supported by something much greater. And I think if we just ask that question, you know, how did we come into being? Then we'll start to realize that there is something greater supporting us. Thank you. Oh, I see Vanessa. Sorry, you're in the dark. Let me see where you are. Here we go. Okay, you're unmuted now.
So I was going to say, sorry, the story of the image of the python in the computer cables is just wonderful.
And as I could tell you.
Thank you. But my question was, how do your writing practice and Zen practice inform each other?
That's a great question. So they share a lot of similarities in that they both can increase awareness, help to process thoughts, help to let go of things, and help to understand our own mind, right? And our own being. They are a bit different in nature in that obviously Zazen is very quiet, but even though you're sitting quietly, thoughts come and go in your head a lot. And then when you're writing, it's about being able to articulate these kind of vague, indecipherable feelings and impulses into words, which is actually can be quite satisfying when you find the right words to tell what's actually going on inside. In some ways, they do similar things for me. And the way that they can actually kind of work together is I notice that if I do Zazen before I write, then my writing is very clear. And there's not jumping around distractions. In fact, if I'm doing like a sesshin type thing or an intensive, you can drop in very deep to where you write things and you're like, where did that even come from? Like koans exploding and, you know, universe can come through. And sometimes you write also complete crap. I mean, you can't control it. It's, but in a way you stop judging it and you just allow it to do its thing. It's like you disappear and writing does writing. And also, similarly, if you're doing a lot of writing, sometimes that can get the junk out and you can feel more settled and then you can have a very peaceful Zazen. So it's, in a way, they're both forms of practice. And I think let's see, in terms of integrating, I mean, you can do them one or the other, you can do them together. In a way though, it all starts to become your everyday life, because being a writer is like, truly being a writer is more than just how do I put words on paper or how do I articulate a story? That's what we think of when it's like, okay, write a book, be published, but that's not writing practice. So writing practice, spiritual practice, is actually mostly listening, right? You're just being receptive, and you have to be present to the world and be present to the feelings inside and be present to, you know, the bed sheets and the color of the wallpaper, and you're just present with everything. And by deeply listening, you disappear. You're just the channel through which it's going on the page, but you kind of are bearing witness and in relationship to everything. So in a way, you're practicing that listening, that deep listening of the world, that deep listening of awareness. It's not about coming up with a new story so much. It's about being present with what's already there. And so in a way, eventually, I'm not there yet, but eventually it's like your whole life becomes meditation, right? Like you've been Tenzo multiple times, and then cooking is a meditation. How do we not waste, and how do we mindfully chop, and how do we take really good care and intention with the meals we prepare? So I think gradually what all practice does, whether you do walking meditation, seated meditation, writing meditation, eventually what all practice does is it teaches us how to take care of our life. It just, and we're never done with it. You know, we're always works in progress. I think Suzuki Roshi said it best. He said, you're already perfect the way you are, and you could use some improvement, right? So I think all of it integrates in that we just learn to take care of our life a little better than we did yesterday. And that can show up in different ways. There were times even when I'd be frustrated or angry or sad or something, having dealt with something really challenging, and I had no time to write and I had no paper and I couldn't sit in meditation. And I would like just literally talk in the car as I drove from one place to another to articulate, like I was doing writing practice, articulate my thoughts and feelings and process it and then let it go. And it was like doing a clearing, like doing writing. It's not the same. I don't recommend, you know, it's not a substitute for Zazen, but you just start integrating it, like taking better care of your life. I mean, one thing that I used to struggle with was having a normal sleep schedule. Like I'd stay up really late some days, I'd feel tired the next day. As a kid, my sleep schedule was all over the place. I won't even go there. And so one thing that all of my practice has done has just been, okay, I feel better when I have a normal sleep schedule. I'm going to stick to a regular sleep schedule. And it's just like that, dealing with the next thing. How do we take care of the next thing? How do we take care of the next thing? So I think every opportunity we have to practice mindfulness in some way helps the rest of our life to support us. I'm not sure if I answered your question, but.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Oh, Jayatri. Yes, go ahead.
Thank you for your lovely talk. Really wonderful to hear everything about your past. And I'm curious, at what point or how did the practice help you in terms of coming to terms with everything you've been through? It's a lot. And coming to peace with some of what you've experienced. And was there a particular point at which, you know, you felt this has been, you know, a turning point for me? If that's something you can share.
Oh yeah, actually I meant to talk a little bit about that. By the way, I hope, my parents, my relationship with my parents is much better now. And we all change. You know, I'm not the same person I was when I was a kid. They're not the same people that they were back then either. They don't destroy furniture anymore or anything like that. Yeah, I think that there's a couple things. The primary thing was that I learned to accept my own mind, and I had a space. It wasn't something where Nat or Les or anyone could give it to me, like, this is your practice. It's something we already have, but they hold a space for you to be yourself, right? And so in the sacred space, I could just be myself and accept whatever came up in my writing or in my being. And accepting myself and taking care of myself was such a big step, because as long as if I didn't take care of myself, or I would still be looking for my mom and dad to do that, right? I would still be looking for them, and then I'd be disappointed because they let me down. So really coming to a place where I had could take care of myself and parent myself, and also have other sources of support, like a community like Sangha, where I felt supported, it kind of reduced my dependency on them to have to fill that gap and be perfect. And let's see. And I think then I had capacity to start to ask questions that I didn't ask before. So I used to be very angry at my dad. In my adolescence, I was very, like, always annoyed at him, and, you know, why can't he just be like a normal dad? And I think he'd actually be fine with me sharing this to you. So one day when I was in my mid 20s and I had done a lot of personal work, and I came to a point where I said, I wonder what my dad went through in his childhood, because he didn't talk a lot about it. And I found out that his dad was an alcoholic, used to beat him, and all this stuff. And I told him, you know what? Thank you, Dad, because even though you've not always been there for me the way I wanted, I realize now that you treated me a million times better than your dad treated you. And thank you for that. And I could actually be grateful. And it's a little bit of a tragedy. What happened is that in Thailand at that time, there wasn't much awareness of learning disabilities. And it turns out, like, my dad is dyslexic. So he'd go to school and he would try reading and all the words would scramble and he couldn't read well. And they didn't know what it was. So everyone just thought he's not trying hard enough, lazy. And his dad would actually hit him, and the teacher would hit him, and they'd say, why aren't you as smart as your sister? So he was a traumatized child. He really was. And at some point he actually ran away from home, but he left in his young teen years, maybe 14 or 15, and went to a Buddhist monastery, Theravada, some monastery with the orange robes. And he wasn't particularly spiritual. He went because he wanted to be independent, and he didn't want to be hurt by his dad anymore, you know, if that makes sense. So, I mean, there's so many stories I could tell you of really difficult things I dealt with my parents. But then when I took time to understand, well, why is he being this way? What happened to him that he feels that, you know, it's tough love and that's the only way? And I realized that compared to what he went through, I was very, very fortunate. And so I could see it. And it didn't make me, you know, enable or feel accept every single type of behavior, but it helped me to understand where he's coming from and that he's doing his best, you know, given the cards that he was dealt. And I think that turning point with my dad was a big one. With my mom, I think it was when I stopped trying to change her, you know, I think it's the trap we always have. We try to change people. Both of my parents struggled with hoarding, with keeping lots of stuff and not taking care of things and stuff. And I was scared for her at one point because the house was getting so cluttered that it was getting dusty. She got pneumonia. And I was like, if she stays here, she could die. And I kept saying, we need to have a garage sale. We need to clean this out. This is not healthy. And the more she just was very stubborn and wouldn't deal with it. And wouldn't move locations. And she had all these memories, and she said, well, but this is where my kids grew up and I don't want to change it. And I don't, you know, it's actually a mental illness. It's actually a condition there. It's unprocessed grief is what causes hoarding. So first of all, understanding what mental illness is, that it's not just someone being stubborn, that they actually it can be hard for them to change it. Like, they might not have control over it. And understanding that, and then it was when I let go. And I said, okay, it's, you know, her, I can't control her. I can only control me. I've offered to help and this is all I can do. And right after I let go, she sold the house, moved out, everything rearranged itself because the you know, what was it? The mortgage loan was just got too crazy. And the moment I stopped carrying all of it and worrying and carrying my parents' financial burdens, then they took care of it. It's weird how that happens, right? So there's something healthy about detaching, not about not caring, but it's about you do what you can and then you understand that people have free will and people are free agents and you can't control them and you have to respect their choices. And it was really like, as soon as I let go, a couple weeks later, the thing straightened out and she's in a better living place. And so sometimes you just need to let go. Yeah. Thank you. I think that's Craig. Yes. Why can't I find you? There you are. Let me unmute you. Okay, go ahead, Craig.
Thanks, Bonnie. I love listening to your story. I love hearing the deeper personal histories of people in the Sangha. And I think this is a great way to be spending our time at home, getting to know each other better from far away. There's one thing I wanted to share that came to mind in part of the earlier conversation, and then I had a question for you. The thing that came to mind was partly related to when you were talking with Dave about, he was talking about the universe and its size and your place in it, and that you're very special in one regard and that you're not in another. And the thing that came to mind is in a book I've been reading on and off recently of Chinese Zen Chan poetry. And the author of this book, he's going through these different poems, and the phrase that he uses a lot is about how we're all the cosmos becoming aware of itself, or awakening to itself, sorry, that's his phrase. And that's kind of one analogy or one metaphor for consciousness, what it is. And given if that's what we all are, then sure, it's nothing special. But wow, like you are the entire cosmos awakening to itself just from your little perspective. It's something that came to mind, how you can be both very vast and incomprehensible and at the same time, nothing special. So that was the thing I wanted to share. My question,
go ahead.
My question was, you were ordained recently, and you mentioned on the day or near the time that it was the culmination of 5 years of thinking or planning related to that, and it didn't crop up in your story, and I was interested to hear about the role or the relevance of ordination, particularly as part of your practice.
Thank you, Craig. So the decision to, well, there's a lot more to the story. Let's see, how can I put it concisely? How I decided to become a priest actually happened. Beautiful things are born out of distress, I guess. My beloved teacher, Natalie, was facing cancer, and we didn't know how long she was going to live. And I was a mess. I mean, I felt like this little green fruit being plucked off the tree too early, and like I'm flailing. I mean, because after not having the most stable upbringing, I was deeply attached to my teacher for a sense of stability. And she was like my hero. She was like, you know, the strong one. She had clarity in her life. And I was very dependent on her, I felt. And when she was diagnosed with cancer, it was hard on everyone. And I remember coming to coffee at Starbucks and just being very distraught about this and like, how am I going to continue my practice, like if she dies? And I remember Les just directly asking me, will you continue your practice in the way that she taught you? And I just answered yes. And I just knew that what I had experienced with Zen so far was going to be a part of my life. It was like drinking water. I mean, it was like a basic hygiene lifeline type thing, whether it was writing practice or Zazen. Somehow that time for quiet reflection and stillness and being had to be part of my life. And because it made such a difference in my life, I wanted to help other people too. I mean, anyone who is practicing and wants encouragement or has questions, I'm going to naturally share. So in a way, it was a natural thing. Like, of course, this is a life commitment. I'm going to do it, you know, regardless, because I feel that it's vital for my well-being and my sanity and for the sanity of the world. So that part was a no-brainer in a way. But I think we all struggle with this thing of, am I ready? Am I good enough? Am I there yet? Am I there yet? And some of that did crop up for me, not of not being committed, but I mean, just a number of things I just have been very open that I struggled with. Like, well, some people were raised vegetarian and I'm not vegetarian. And I, you know, I need to try to be better at that before I'm this, and I need to make this better. And my room is still a mess, and you can't be a Zen priest. You know, just like, and at some point you realize that you're never going to be perfect. And it's like, okay, I'm good enough. I'm good enough to help people, and I'm doing my best. And also it's like, in some ways, just taking the plunge and being a priest, it's, Brenda said it to me this way when I first got my robes. It's like, the robes will teach you how to be a priest. I mean, you're wearing long sleeves like this and you just turn around and you'll clear a whole table if you're not paying attention, you know? So in some way, you're never going to be fully ready, but it's just, it was something that was in my heart that I just felt like this practice is always going to be part of my life, and I'm always going to want to help people who are also on the same path, and that I don't need to be perfect or a guru. And in some ways, it just helps that we have priests that are ordinary people trying to do the right thing and with ordinary struggles like everyone else. So that was my process, I guess.
Thanks, Bonnie. I appreciate that.
Thanks, Craig. Oh, I see Megan and Janet. Okay, so we'll do Megan and then Janet. Go ahead, Megan.
I just wanted to say I really appreciated your talk and your openness about your childhood, and I'm glad that I came tonight to hear it. No questions.
Hey, Megan. And Janet, who's in New Mexico, my beloved New Mexico. I miss the adobe so much.
Yes, greetings from New Mexico. And I just hope that Natalie hears this talk. Mm. And thank you so much. I love you.
Oh, love you too, Janet. Yeah, I'll send it to her. Although I'm a tiny little square on the screen, but she'll be able to hear it. I should send that to her. Thank you. And enjoy those beautiful adobe buildings, because that was my first Zen experience. And I love that area.
This talk was brought to you by the Cannondoe Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to cannondoe.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N. D-O.O-R-G.